This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stachow. Many Americans know what happened on November 22, 1963. President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed. But many don't know that another politician was gravely injured in that shooting, former Texas Governor John Connally. The majority of doctors at Parkland Hospital that day focused on keeping the president alive. So who cared for the governor, and what was it like to be in his operating room? Dr. Theodore Pappas has developed a deep curiosity for these lesser-known medical histories. He's the Vice Dean for Medical Affairs at the Duke University School of Medicine. He's also a professor of surgical innovation and the chief of the Division of Advanced Oncologic and GI Surgery at Duke. Now, that's what Ted does during the day. But on nights and weekends, he dedicates his free time to investigating the medical treatment of major political figures. He's written several papers outlining what kind of care political giants received at the hands of their doctors. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you very much.
So why do you do this with your free time? What interests you?
Well, I guess I'm a historian as a hobby, sort of wanted to be a history major in college, never got to it. And somehow later in my career, I found this as a fun thing to do.
And how did you get into this? Tell me about the event that precipitated your interest in medical stories of the past.
About 10 years ago, I had found out or heard about Lyndon Johnson having his gallbladder removed while he was a sitting president. And I was introduced to a surgeon who was in the room that day. He was a retired Mayo Clinic surgeon. I called him up on the phone, and he told me the whole story. And he had took notes, and he read me those notes. And I realized the story had never been told. So I figured I had a manuscript to tell what exactly happened. So it was big fun, and employed a Duke medical student to help me with the project, and we wrote a paper. It was great.
And when you write these papers, you're looking at the details of what happened that day, but you're also putting them into historical and social context. So tell me about the interplay of those two things and why you think looking through this lens of a medical narrative informs us in a different way about these events that we think we know.
Well, there's always an interesting issue that happens around these events. Lyndon Johnson was a great example. When the surgeons went to talk to Lyndon Johnson, his questions were not about the operation. They were about, when am I going to be able to function as president again? When am I going to speak to the press? Because scheduling the operation was going to be on a Friday, so he had 2 days to recover. So on Monday, he was ready to go. And that was very enlightening to me, learning what presidents are thinking about when they're doing things that you and I do every day. We're thinking about how big is the incision. He didn't care about that. He wanted to know about when he could function as president. Very informing stuff.
So when you're looking at these various historical case studies, what are you're looking at answering sort of two basic questions. Tell me what those are.
Well, I try to judge the event in the day. So the medical events have to be interpreted based on what the doctors have at their hands, what they can actually do, what is the standard of care in the day, and what information they have. Now, we do later reflect on if it happened today, would we do it the same, which makes it just kind of fun. But if you're trying to judge performance, you have to do it in the day. You have to figure out what they had available and how they use those to take care of that patient. And then the surrounding political and social events are always impactful and always interesting, which create real meaning to all of it, because we may have seen these events from one side, and when you realize what was happening medically, you look at it from a totally different angle.
Such as in the example of JFK not even realizing that there may have been someone else who needed to be medically operated on. Tell me the story of how you started looking into Governor John Connally.
Well, Red Duke was a very famous trauma surgeon who was in Texas, finished his career there. But at the time of the JFK shooting, he was a surgical resident, second-year surgical resident, and he was sitting in the cafeteria. He told me this story, by the way. It's a great story. He said he was sitting in the cafeteria. Suddenly, there's an overhead page. Everybody had to go to the emergency room. He got there about a minute or two late, and as he walks around the corner of room one in the ER, there's Jackie Kennedy sitting with blood on her dress right in front of the door. And in he walks in. There's 30 people trying to keep the president alive, and they don't need him. And the chief resident says, "You better go across the hallway because there's a guy who's dying over there. We don't know who he is." And he walks across in the hallway, opens the door, and there's John Connally taking his last breath.
So the guy who we don't know who he is the governor of Texas.
He's the governor of Texas,
okay.
Right, who was sitting just in front of JFK. And actually, one of the bullets that went through JFK hit Connally and injured his lung. And so this second-year surgical resident, Red Duke, resuscitated him and normally in those days would have operated himself, but realized, oh, this is the governor of Texas. I need to call somebody. And they called the chief of thoracic surgery and they saved his life.
So when you mentioned you spoke with him directly, tell me about the kind of research that you do when you're looking into these various cases.
Well, of course, we're trying to get primary sources. I think that's the most important thing. I think you can get misled by just reading what other people have written. And so newspaper is a great source because you can find out what was being reported in the day. Some of these manuscripts are based on oral histories. So, for example, if you have a president and you go to the presidential library online, there'll be oral histories often where people will have dictated or transcribed an interview where you hear about what actually happened. So you try to get primary information and not just read what everybody says. And I think you learn a lot when you get primary data.
You mentioned that we can't always trust what's been written before. And I think President Garfield is an interesting example of how the existing narrative may not be exactly what happened. Tell me about your looking into that case.
Well, the Garfield assassination happened in an environment where the doctors were accused of doing something wrong. And that actually was an accusation that happened in the day. The assassin, when he came to trial, when they said, "You killed the president," he said, "No, I shot the president. The doctors killed him." Hmm. He actually said that at his own trial.
Because the president didn't die until
about 80 days.
80 days after.
80 days later. And, okay. And so the narrative was that the doctors must have messed up something. Now, again, this is 1880. No CAT scanners, no IV fluids, no antibiotics. And so they were managing a gunshot wound and trying to figure out what happened. And eventually the president died. And so historically, you read a lot of stuff and everybody will have said that the doctors messed up. And then there was a popular novel that came out several years ago by Candace Millard, which basically supported that. It was a very well-written book. And so a lot of people read it. And I looked at that and I thought, I wonder what really happened. And so I, again, got a medical student to work on this. And we sort of started digging around trying to find original sources. And we eventually found the autopsy, which was published in the New York Times. Who knew why it would be in the New York Times? But sure enough, autopsy was published in the New York Times. We read it and realized that the narrative about the doctors messing up was not right at all. That, in fact, he died of a bullet injuring a major artery that had sealed temporarily and eventually broke open 80 days later. He bled to death, and that was a complication of the original gunshot wound. And then we also found that he had a bad gallbladder that was only discovered at autopsy, again, before ultrasound, before CAT scan. And they had no idea that he developed a gallbladder problem. And the idea of an association between a gunshot wound and a gallbladder problem only came out in the Vietnam War, you know, almost a century later. And so the doctors at the time had no idea that they should expect any problem with the gallbladder. So the paper was about, you know, I don't know about vindicating the doctors, but trying to tell the story that I think reflected the facts.
And I can imagine some people hearing that who would say, okay, but today we know a lot more about the gallbladder. We would never make that kind of mistake. Why is it really worth us going back to the late 1880s and thinking about what happened to President Garfield? What kind of argument would you make for why this retrospective analysis is necessary or why it's worth doing?
Well, certainly when we teach our students and our residents, we teach that you analyze yourself and other people and the complications that might occur around the time of surgery in the environment that is occurring. You put yourself in their shoes and you interpret the events based on the data they had and how they made decisions. Looking back is easy, but you have to figure out what did they actually know and how did they get that information and did they do the best they could based on that information? And that's the same lesson.
It seems to me in reviewing your papers that we can learn a lot about the great pressure that is put on the physicians and surgeons who are taking care of these high-profile individuals. Can you tell me a little bit about what you've learned about what it's like to be in that position and how it alters how you do your job?
Well, fair enough. I mean, I think everybody feels that pressure when I talked to some of the people I've mentioned, the surgeon that helped operate on LBJ, for example. It was very clear that this was not the normal patient and very clear they were trying to do the things they normally do, but also very clear that it never turns out that way, that they end up doing things because of the surrounding social event, political event that often stretch the indication. And that you fall into that trap and you try not to, I think, as a surgeon and doctor.
So President Eisenhower, he had a big heart attack. He had an operation for a bowel blockage and a stroke all in the same pregnancy. So there was a lot of concern that is he fit enough, physically fit enough to be serving in that role? How do you make the determination whether or not someone is fit for service? And then how is Eisenhower's case an interesting example of how this determination can be made?
Well, it was a different era. We now have an amendment to the Constitution that actually dictates how you pass power from presidents to vice presidents. But that all occurred before that amendment was made. And so at the time, it was always done informally about who's in charge and are they fit for service and can they still be president. He was in the hospital a month with his heart attack. It's unimaginable today. If we had a president in the hospital a month, what we would all do, we'd panic. And yet, at that time, he was in the hospital a month and then within 6 months had a major operation. It's amazing that we, as Americans, we've changed on how we feel about presidents. Back then in the 50s, people took it as what it was.
And there were people who were daily reporting on what was happening. How do privacy concerns and HIPAA come into play with these kind of things where there is a public need to know how the head of your nation is doing, but he or she is a private individual, or is not a private individual, but has a medical history that may not need to be revealed to the full public?
You know, having read the newspaper events of most of these manuscripts, and then also knowing the backstory because you have oral histories that have been given by the surgeon that did the operations, most of the ones in the 50s and 60s, that was all public, very public, and there weren't many secrets. Now, if you go back further, there was a very famous operation done on Grover Cleveland when he was president that was secretly done on a yacht in the harbor in New York, where they got on a boat and they brought two surgeons and an anesthesia person, and they did a surgery on the president's mouth because he had a little cancer in there. And the story never came out for about 17 years till when the surgeon retired. This is after the president died. The surgeon retired and he told the whole story. But that was way back when secrets were important, at least they thought they were.
There's obviously parallels to be made between concerns that people have had about our current president and his health and the determinations made around that. And there have been interesting instances in the past where we haven't trusted the president's first doctor, like Nixon, for example. Tell me about the mistrust and what that led to surrounding the Watergate scandal.
So the paper we wrote was about the events just after he stepped down as president. And right after that, he developed a complication of a blood clot in his leg. Now, he had been flying all over the world for many years, and one of the complications of being in a plane too long is getting blood clots. He had a complication of that and needed surgery for it. This is after he stepped down, right during the Watergate trial. And so when he was called to testify, he was recovering from and had a major complication from a big operation, almost died, actually. And so his attorney called back to D.C. and said, he can't come. He's too sick. And Judge Sirica, who was the judge in that case, thought he was lying and hired three famous doctors to fly to the West Coast and examine the ex-president and find out what was up. And they, sure enough, they flew out there, examined him, verified that he was very sick and could not come to the trial, and reported back to the judge, and that was why he never actually testified in the Ehrlichman and Haldeman case, because he was sick. It's a little footnote of history, but it was all for medical reasons. He had complications from an operation.
So that incident raises a question for me of who is an objective decision maker when it comes to these extremely high-profile cases. For you as a surgeon, has looking back on the history of these various incidents informed how you make decisions around your patients or how you think about the pressures put on you as a surgeon and as a decision maker?
Well, I think I'm always reminded that you have to stick to the usual rules. No matter what is swirling around and no matter what pressures you might feel from family or other situations, you have to basically deliver the goods. You've got to be the same doctor delivering the same standard of care. Obviously, emotionally, you need to support the patient and family, but the actual care you deliver has to be the same based on the events you're seeing in front of you, no matter what those other pressures are. It's not easy, but that's what we have to do.
Tell me about who you're looking into now. Is that the MLK's assassination?
Yeah, we've just started the research on Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, and so we've got some more work to do. I'm working with some vascular surgeons at Duke. It is an injury to a blood vessel. That's what he died of. And so there are some interesting things around how he got to the hospital and what happened in the resuscitation. And again, we'll tell the story about was it appropriate for the day, and then we'll also tell the story about if he was injured today, whether we would have done anything differently. So it's already a fun story. We're about halfway through it, but there are some interesting nuances, as there are with all these stories.
You are looking back at moments that are still controversial to this day: JFK's assassination, RFK's assassination, lots of conspiracy theories ongoing. Has it changed your own personal views of how these events took place, or what's important to think about when looking back and trying to reconstruct the timeline?
Well, I think the conspiracy issues always come up in any famous person that gets shot. It's amazing. Bobby Kennedy, there were almost 50 people that saw the assassination, and there's still conspiracy theories about it. But I think what's most helpful, if you really dig out and get primary information, look at autopsy reports, look at real data, it often clears up what some of those controversial issues are.
Well, Dr. Theodore Pepis, thank you so much for joining the conversation today. He is the Vice Dean for Medical Affairs at the Duke University School of Medicine, also a professor of surgical innovation and the chief of the Division of Advanced Oncologic and GI Surgery. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You can find more about him and everything else we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Jennifer Brookland, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is the technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.